This is Cincinnati Edition on 91.7 WVXU. I'm Michael Mungs. Today, our focus is on historic preservation in local Black communities. We're going to explore landmarks in Evanston, the West End, and Glendale. We start in Evanston, and we're joined via Zoom by Gregory Stewart, Preservation Chair of the Evanston Community Council. Gregory, welcome to our program.
Thank you.
We also have with us Mary Ward, who attended St. Mark's School and Church. Mary, welcome to you as well.
Hi, Mike. How are you?
I'm doing well. So glad you could be with us. And just for our listeners' sake, I'll let you know that while this is airing on Monday, we recorded this last week on that big snow day, and I couldn't make it into the studio. So if we sound a little different today, it's because we are recording today's program remotely. Gregory, I do want to start with you in Evanston. You are the past president of the Evanston Community Council. And as I mentioned, currently serving on the Community Council as the preservation chair. One landmark in your community is the St. Mark Church, and that is of particular concern to you. Would you mind telling our listeners what the St. Mark Church is and what its significance is to you and your community?
Thank you for the opportunity to share about a treasure in our neighborhood. The Evanston community prizes the St. Mark Catholic Church. It's located at 3500 Montgomery Road at the intersection of Montgomery and Duck Creek. And I'm sure tens of thousands of your listeners will recognize that you could see the tower, the 130-foot tower from I-71 and Montgomery Road. And it stands as a jewel in the heart of not only our neighborhood, but in the heart of Cincinnati. The Evanston Community Council, great things we believe are going on in our neighborhood. And one of the great things is that we, as a community, recently did a 10-year plan. We looked at the successes of our neighborhood and looked at the assets, and we certainly believe that St. Mark's Church is an asset that we want to see revived and reactivated. It is, as I mentioned, a jewel in our neighborhood, an architectural masterpiece. Something that could not be replicated in 2021. And so we see it as a real jewel to be maintained and renovated.
What would you like to see it be used for?
So the church is over 100 years old. I do want to thank the former St. Mark's parishioners for what they did to create this jewel and the fact that because of the merger of a number of churches, the church left there in 2010. Once again, I'm thanking them for the fact that they kept their food pantry open to 2017 as a resource for over 700 families. We'd like to see the facility, the church, and the rectory building reactivated, not only as an event center, but that it might be used for community events. And once again, not just for Evanston, but it's a magnificent facility that could hold 800 people in the chapel area, another several hundred people in the lower dining area, the rectory building being one that could be renovated for smaller nonprofits, for for-profit businesses, for a number of activities that would benefit the community and benefit the region.
Who owns the church now?
Currently, the Archdiocese owns the church.
And is this something that you personally or the organization of which you're a part would like to acquire?
The Evanston Community Council is part of the 10-year plan, clearly stated in that plan that we would like to see the facility to be retained. A group of Evanston residents, predominantly Evanston residents, have formed a nonprofit called The Mark. In that group, our goal is to eventually acquire St. Mark's to renovate it.
And that's Gregory Stewart, past president of Evanston Community Council, currently Evanston Community Council Preservation Chair. We're also joined by Mary Ward. Mary, the St. Mark Church in Evanston was home to a vibrant and predominantly African-American Catholic parish, and you attended this as a young girl. Share with us some of your memories.
Well, I want to preface by saying that I'm not Catholic. I actually attended St. Mark's School, which is adjacent to the church, which is now Alliance Academy. So from attending the school, that meant that we went to Mass periodically. So for me, what it meant, I felt a sense of family, of community. And at one point, I was so enamored with everybody at the church, I actually wanted to be a nun. I thought it was the coolest thing. It was these group of ladies. They had this house that they hung out in, and they were our teachers, and I loved them. They were confidants. They distributed discipline, and it wasn't so terrible now looking back on it. It was real guidance, and I absolutely, totally was all for it. I loved going to Mass. I remember when Sister Kelly took me to my first midnight Mass. I attended regularly. I went through the catechism classes. I had no idea what was going on. I was just caught up in how they made me feel, and I wanted to be part of it.
I have to say, as someone who attended Catholic school also, for you to say you attended Mass periodically, that's being awfully generous. I can remember going quite frequently. But talk a little bit about what that church, what that school meant to your community, even for someone like you who was not Catholic, even though you were clearly immersed in the religion.
Yes. St. Mark's, the church and the school, was family. And when I say it was family, I look back on my years there, thinking about the people who actually attended. And they were neighbors. So I was able to actually meet other people that went to St. Mark's who I didn't know about. When I initially started school, I was in public school. And when the public school, my parents decided to take us out and put us in St. Mark's, my friendships expanded because I was able to meet other families who actually attended church. And some of those families are actually still my really, really good friends, like the Berries. So I was able to meet them. At one point, my father actually taught. he was a substitute teacher, and he was on the school board. And also, too, he started a small little gym, boxing gym, in St. Mark's gym. So it was open to the community. Everybody that went there actually bonded and got to know each other. And from those relationships back then, they've actually nurtured now as we are adults. So I can really say that whole community there, from being in the church and actually going to school, it's like really, really tight knit. Honestly, the grade school, we have a reunion that we do every other year. So we reach out to as many people who are still alive and ask them to come back to Cincinnati, to St. Mark's. We've reached out to teachers. Sister Claire was able to come to our last reunion. And unfortunately, she passed away not shortly afterwards. So we actually reach out to the staff. We want them to come back and everybody from every year to get together. And one of our big things we like to do is like tour the church and we reminisce and we talk about things and Dr. Pepper, the paddle that Mrs. Moore had. We have a really good time.
Well, Mary, you've been in Evanston a long time. What do you think it would mean for that community as you've watched the changes take place over the decades? What do you think it would mean for your neighborhood, for that structure, that building, to see some revitalization?
I'm going to tell you that it's needed. If you think of St. Mark's as an old guy, he's been in our neighborhood. He's a sentinel. He's watched us. He's watched us come from little children to adults. He's watched the changes. I've been in Evanston long enough to remember in the 60s when there was uproar. He's seen that. St. Mark's has seen the time before 71. He's seen us come through and go to masses. He's seen some people get married there. Some of our students, he's seen them go on to be international stars. St. Mark's is our friend, and it's someone that we feel attached to, and it's a shame that he's sitting there and we've left him alone. He needs to be revitalized and opened back up because he still has many, many, many more years to give us. Just looking at the stained glass and thinking about the awesomeness of going into the building, all of that is still there. We need to uncover it. We need to remove the years of neglect, the debris, and show our building some love and bring him back. And it can be a space in our community where people can gather, where the rectory that I can remember that you never went to unless you got in trouble. Now I'm not afraid to go in there. I can see the beauty of the space and what that could be for offices, for people in the community to come together. It's so many different things that we could do with that building. I really want to see us move forward and develop it.
That's Mary Ward, who attended St. Mark's School and Church in Evanston before its closure. We're also joined by Gregory Stewart, the current preservation chair at the Evanston Community Council. He's also a past president of the Evanston Community Council. Gregory, you talked about the MARC, the formation of the MARC, this nonprofit arm that hopes to lead any revitalization efforts at St. Mark. What are the next steps for your organization?
There is a website, and it is SaveSt.MarkNoSpaces.com, and it shows photos of the grandness of this treasure. It also shows the fact that there, as Mary mentioned, has been unfortunately damaged to the building over time with water and other issues. And so our hope is that as we reach out to various possible partners throughout the city, that we will see a real campaign occur to provide the financial resources for the purchase of the property and then for the renovation and reopening of the facilities.
Historic preservation is not cheap. I don't have to tell you that, I imagine. Any idea on what a total cost might end up being?
We do have several ways that we've gathered specific information, and I could share just a little bit of that. And I do want to thank the Cincinnati Preservation Association first to say thank you for helping to gather the historic information about St. Mark, that this is a historic structure. The architect, Henry Slacks, who designed St. Mark's, is a world-known architect and predominantly from the Chicago area, but he also was the founder of the School of Architecture at Notre Dame. And so he created this treasure for us. In terms of the cost to renovate, we have a sense of what it costs to stabilize it, to fix the details. We'd rather not disclose a specific total amount, but thanks to partners like the Port of Cincinnati, the City of Cincinnati, and others, we do have a very detailed plan of what the cost would be.
And Mary, you told our producers before we started the program that when you drive by it, it's hard to look at St. Mark. And I know it's a building that you have great fondness for, as you've shared with us already, but could you tell us a little bit about that difficulty in looking at it now, knowing your past connections to it and what it used to be?
Looking at it, to see it just crumble before our eyes, and to think about all the wonderful memories that we had there, all the things that happened. It's difficult to watch because it is such a beautiful space, and it's a vibrant space, and it shouldn't be allowed to just sit and crumble when we could actually use it. We talk sometimes in our communities about people not having things to do. I do a lot of volunteer work with kids. That's a space, if we could revitalize it, art programs, dancing, we could have so many different offerings there, revitalize the food pantry for our friends and neighbors in our community. It's difficult to watch knowing that it's a space that we could really utilize and make vibrant again. It's very difficult to watch.
And I know, Gregory, you didn't want to give like full amounts as it relates to potential costs, but in our last 30 seconds or a minute together, what's your timeline?
The St. Mark's Board, our next step obviously is going to have to be the purchase of the property. And so we are in our fundraising campaign for that. Once again, SaveSt.Mark.com, and the idea that we are reaching out for that is a general donor base, but also we are approaching foundations as well as government entities to see about the possible assistance in the purchase price. So we're hoping that that will occur in 2021. We believe this is something that cannot be allowed to not be revised. So we hope that will happen this year.
And the Archdiocese of Cincinnati is engaged and possibly interested in talking?
We've had conversations, and so we're in that point of trying to come to a term.
Gregory Stewart is the past president of the Evanston Community Council and a current Evanston Community Council Preservation Chair, and Mary Ward is a resident there who attended St. Mark's School and Parish. Gregory and Mary, thank you so much for the time you gave us.
Thank you, Mike.
Thank you for having us.
This is Cincinnati Edition on 91.7 WVXU. I'm Michael Monks. We continue now with our exploration of historic preservation in local Black communities with a visit to the West End. We're joined by Gerald Cooper, the founder of a popular Instagram account called Hood Century Modern, which showcases the connection between mid-century modern architecture and Black culture. Gerald, welcome to the show.
Thank you for having me, Michael.
Our pleasure to have you. And also with us is Anne Delano Steinert, a visiting assistant professor at the University of Cincinnati and founder of the Over the Rhine Museum. Anne, welcome to you as well.
Hi, thanks for having me.
Our pleasure to have you. Gerald, I'm looking at Hood Century Modern on Instagram as we speak right now. You've got almost 38,000 followers, really beautiful images of mid-century architecture and Black culture. And the description of this page says, yes, there is mid-century modern design in the hood. Is that something that surprises people?
Yeah, for sure. I mean, especially when you don't know a design is mid-century. You know, there's so much of the basic design knowledge in North America that hasn't hit certain groups. And it's actually called Hood Mid-Century Modern for everybody out there. Hood Mid-Century Modern on Instagram.
You're right. I apologize for that.
Hood, oh, good. Oh, good. Oh, good. Because I call it Hood Century. There is a disconnect between, sort of built spaces and African-Americans. And so this account attempts in a very like fun, artsy, informative way. Looks to look at that issue, you know, in a dope way, you know.
How did you become interested in that?
I don't know. I don't know at what point it happened. You know, I'm a Montessori kid here. I went to Carson Montessori on the West Side in Jacobs Center, and then I went to Purcell Marion. But Montessori, you know, really helps you connect with your surroundings, both in visual and different ways of learning, as well as, you know, just being outside and like identifying things. And so I grew up in College Hill and went to church at Revelation Baptist in the West End. And so, being in OTR, my parents are from the West End. And so, you know, being in OTR a bunch, I remember looking at these buildings like, huh, this looks like New York, you know, and working in the restock program in junior high school and some of the programs. I'm like, man, like, this stuff just really started to speak to me. And so I wanted to identify architecture, but not, you know, I never went to architecture school. I just wanted to identify it so I could call it by its name. And a lot of that identification is lacking, you know, amongst marginalized groups, specifically African-Americans that I'm connected to. And I wanted to shift that. And it's literally shifting. Like people basically are DMing me every day. Like, oh my God, I look at my, you know, my neighborhood differently, you know?
Well, Gerald, let's talk a little bit about this Instagram account that you run, Hood Mid-Century Modern, you lovingly call Hood Century. It is popular. You've got, as I noted, about 38,000 followers now. When did that start to gain traction and did it surprise you?
Oh my God, I'm surprised as I talk to you right now. I mean, you know, the creative director of Louis Vuitton is following and very active, and you know, all of the top, you know, creative directors and thinkers in the space, Black artists are following and engaging at a high rate. And so I guess, so it started very, very late December of 19. So just over a year ago. And I was home from Los Angeles. And I was actually was going through a breakup. So I was a bit down. And I was looking for that inspiration. I was looking for that zest in life. And I was in College Hill, my mom's house where I grew up. And I was walking up the street and I saw this, you know, this modern. And I've been living between Los Angeles and London. And so, you know, oftentimes being able to culturally identify for me became looking at architecture, right? I can see like who was here or, you know, who's here now. And so Southern California has tons of modern, all of the case studies and everything. And so I was like, oh man, like that, like that's like, it's one on my, it's like three on my crib, you know? And so I call them like the first case study hood century. And I just, that moment, I went to my personal Instagram and I just made like a fake case study, you know, to my friends and my Instagram stories. And then a couple of my guys who I really respect like highly, they were like, yo, this is a thing. That's literally what happened. I wanted to show my friends that there was modern in neighborhoods like College Hill. And the side of College Hill I live in is the blue collar side. I mean, I've never seen redlining like this. It's like, you know, you coming up Hamilton, you got the left side. It's like, you know, nice, you know, course for Scottsdale. And then the right side right there, College Hill Presbyterian. You could tell it's just like working class, a couple of beautiful historic buildings there. But it was a real thing. Like I want my people to identify the biggest assets in their neighborhood.
That's Gerald Cooper, founder of the Instagram account Hood Mid-Century Modern. We're going to talk a little bit about the importance of preserving these black spaces coming up with you, Gerald. Let's turn now to Ann Delano Steinert, visiting assistant professor at the University of Cincinnati and founder of the Over the Rhine Museum. And we brought you on to talk about the West End as a whole, and particularly the historic significance of Revelation Baptist Church. So would you mind telling us about Revelation?
Sure. Thank you. So I think the reason people ask me to speak about the West End is that I, in 2017, curated a show called Finding Canyon Bar, which was an exhibit of historic photographs, which are held by Cincinnati Museum Center, that document the lower half of the West End below Ezra Charles Drive, which was demolished due to a so-called urban renewal project beginning in 1959. And so as I shared those photographs, and that exhibit has shown in seven locations around Cincinnati, people come to think of me as like the person who knows about the West End. But I just want to be really clear that I'm an outsider to the West End. I did not live in the West End, and that I would always defer to West End residents and people who are more familiar with the West End to really get a sense of what it was like to live there. What I bring is this kind of scholarly and academic approach. I can tell you what's in the archives about the West End, and I'm a professional historic preservationist, so I can read the buildings and talk about their architectural character, but just be really clear that to get the real scoop on the West End, you should talk to people like Gerald Cooper, who actually lived there and worshiped there. Just to talk a little bit more about Revelation, I actually ended up using Revelation for one of the chapters of my recent PhD dissertation, which focused on using historic buildings as primary source documents to teach us about the past. And so I did a lot of research about the history of Revelation, and I can kind of run through just the quick basics. I will try to just sort of skim because I have the potential to geek out and go really deep into details, but I'll try to just give you the basics. So Revelation Baptist Church, which was on John Street at the corner of Bower and John, was originally built by a Jewish congregation, the Congregation of Brotherly Love. Their name in Hebrew is Akabeth Akim. And that congregation was founded in 1848 in rented rooms at the corner of 15th and Pleasant in Over the Rhine. And then the first thing they did is they gathered money to actually buy a Jewish cemetery, to create a Jewish cemetery for their congregation. So the Jewish cemetery that we know on Ludlow Avenue in Clifton was originally their cemetery. That was the first thing they bought. Then they started to raise money. They actually bought land on Race Street between Liberty and 15th. They built a wooden synagogue there, and they worshiped there beginning in 1849. And then in 1865, they wanted something more substantial. So they bought the land where Revelation was at the corner of John and Bower, and began construction of that building in 1865. Interestingly, they sold the land that they had on Ray Street to Trinity Lutheran Church, which we'll come back around in the story again in a second. So in 1865, they signed a 100-year lease with the estate of David Wade for the land. David Wade is one of Cincinnati's earliest pioneers, earliest white settlers who, you know, took the land from other folks who were here before he got there. He arrived in Cincinnati in 1790. So that's just 2 years after Cincinnati was found by white folks. This land has been held by him all the way since those early years. In 1865, his heirs lease it to the Congregation of Brotherly Love. And they build this brick temple there, becomes known as the John Street Temple. It's fairly typical German religious construction, tall and narrow to fit in a slender urban lot. Their first service was held there in 1866. So think about what's happening. 1865, when this building's under construction, this building is built during the Civil War. So we look back at the past and we think the Civil War was like bazillions of years ago, right? But here was a building that was a living document of the bricks that were laid and the mortar that was put, you know, laid down during the Civil War, right? So they're an Orthodox Jewish congregation. Until they begin to feel the effects of the preaching of Isaac M. Wise. So Isaac Wise is not the pastor or the rabbi at this congregation, but he's preaching to all the German Jewish congregations throughout Cincinnati about the Reform movement. And so this congregation actually begins to transform itself in 1871 from an Orthodox congregation to a Reform congregation. Those reforms impact the building. Instead of having men seated downstairs and a women's balcony above, they join together and have family seating beginning in 1871, and they make lots of other reforms to move to Reform Judaism. There is, at the time that the revelation was demolished, there was actually still a mikveh, a ritual bath, in the basement of Revelation Baptist Church, just a stone pit that would have been used for bathing. They go strong. It's an important German Jewish congregation, but unfortunately, the Jewish community of Cincinnati begins to shift from the West End and moves up Reading Road into Avondale. So by 1904, this congregation is just down to about 40 members. They merge with Sharif Israel, and they get together to move to the Reading Road Temple, which is itself now a Black Baptist church. They sell the land to a Lutheran church, a new Lutheran church called Emmaus Lutheran, which is a splinter group that has splintered off from Trinity Lutheran, who originally bought their old land. That congregation moves in 1904. They celebrate 10 years in the building in 1914 by adding beautiful stained glass windows. They electrify the building. They build a new pulpit. By 1927, they actually reunite with their mother church and move back in with Trinity into their old space at 15 on race at between 15th and Liberty. So that's when in 1927, Horace and Malvina Suddeth purchased the building. These are a married couple, a well-known African-American they're real estate brokers, and they buy the building in 27, and in 1928 they transfer the building to Revelation Baptist Church. Gerald can tell you a lot more about the history of Revelation Baptist Church, but it was founded in 1921. The original pastor was Reverend Wesley Thomas, and they moved a few times before they wind up owning this building at John and Bauer. So The church is going strong. It's a home as the Great Migration accelerates. The West End is filling up with more and more African Americans. The West End, the Black population of the West End was just over 20,000 in 1920, but by 1935, just 15 years later, it's almost 40,000. So the Black population in the West End nearly doubles in a 15-year period, right when Revelation is making their mark in this neighborhood, right? So one thing that really affects the church is in 1956, Liberty Street is widened so that what had been a church on a little kind of side street, now the entire north facade becomes exposed to Liberty Street, which is now a wide, as we know today, busy, busy street, right? So that sort of changes the orientation of the church. Most important national implications of this church are their connection to Reverend Fred Shuttlesworth, who was came to Revelation Baptist Church. He was called there as pastor in 1961. Obviously, most people know the history of Fred Shuttlesworth. He was really important in the civil rights movement in Birmingham. His house was bombed on Christmas Day of 1956. He was beat up. Bull Connor said he wished that he could see him going off in a hearse. He was really an active, important figure in the civil rights movement, together with Ralph Abernathy and Martin Luther King. He came here in Cincinnati to preach in 1960. And at that time, Revelation was looking for a pastor. And one particular parishioner who was involved in their music ministry, Louise Shropshire, got really involved and gave an emotional plea. Shuttlesworth had already said no, he didn't want to come to Cincinnati, but she convinced him. So he comes here in 1961 and serves the church from 61 to 66. It's during that period that he's also doing his most important civil rights work in Birmingham. So I would like to, I like to point out that it's this church, Revelation, that is, you know, paying his salary and keeping his family safe away from the danger of Birmingham, while he is able to travel back and forth and really do the most important national level civil rights work of his career.
Well, Anna, I know you've done a dissertation level amount of research. I just want to make sure that we don't run out of time. I was totally enthralled and may have lost track of time there for a moment. So hopefully we can have you back on to talk about a lot of things, because it's all very fascinating. But just fast forward to the current situation there involving that church.
Yeah. So the church was demolished by, it was sold to, the congregation sold it to FC Cincinnati. And it was demolished about just under a year ago in May. And it is now a vacant lot for construction parking, unfortunately.
Okay. And that is Anne Delano Steinert, visiting assistant professor at the University of Cincinnati and founder of the Over the Rhine Museum. I want to turn back now to Gerald Cooper, who has connections to the West End and this church, and is also the founder of Hood Mid-Century Modern, a very popular Instagram channel. Gerald, what's lost when a historic Black church like that is taken away?
You know, it's really nothing we could measure. We haven't really figured out the barometer to measure, the loss yet. But I think that from a surface level, if you push, north or I guess it would be a bit north. If you push through Liberty, I mean, you can kind of feel the loss. And I don't want to sound like a broken record. Yeah, I listen to NPR a lot, so I don't want to the cultures. I mean, we all know it's lost. And what's really significant, and especially from this history, is that, out of the, from the Great Migration comes folks like my great aunts and grandmother and friends and family that I know. And then now this, to the West End, and now, the West End has nobody. I mean, it's literally nobody from the OG West End there, and all respect to the families who are there currently. But, generally speaking, statistically speaking, this neighborhood has been wiped out, and it continues to happen. And I wonder when it's going to be a thing, when people are going to sort of not think that that's cool or but right now it's pretty fashionable.
And let me just, in our last minute together, Anne, turn back to you. And just, you did note, you prefaced your previous comments with that you're not a West Ender. You're someone who's approached this as an academic. What does the story of Revelation represent in Cincinnati's history, particularly as it relates to its racial history?
Well, I think what it points out to me is that the professional practice of historic preservation locally and nationally has really been unable to see the value in historically Black faces. So the National Register has 2% of all of its National Register listings refer to Black heritage, Black history sites. And clearly that's not representative of our American population, right? And so I think one of the things that happened with Revelation is there was this addition put on the north side, the side now facing exposed to Liberty, in 1976, which most people read as an intrusion, right? That it disrupted the visual and aesthetic character of the building, rather than seeing it as an act of advocacy or agency on the part of that Black congregation. And I would say it was Hood Century Modern. It really was of its moment in 1976. Preservationists perceive that as a disruption in the integrity of the building. And so that it no longer portrayed its period of significance with integrity, which is me something that we have to fix. How do we create a preservation system that really honors all the layers and all the progression through time that this building saw? It's unfortunate. It's incredibly unfortunate that we lost the opportunity to use this building as a tool to teach all this whole range of Cincinnati's history.
Ann Delano Steinert is a visiting assistant professor at the University of Cincinnati and founder of the Over the Rhine Museum. And Gerald Cooper is the founder of Hood Mid-Century Modern on Instagram. Highly recommend you check out that page. Some really beautiful photos and commentary. Gerald, and I do hope you can both come back sometime to talk more about these types of issues. I think it would be a fascinating conversation. So thanks to both of you for the time you gave us today.
Thank you.
This is Cincinnati Edition on 91.7 WVXU. I'm Michael Monks. Bill Parrish is a fourth-generation resident of Glendale, and he's written a book about its history as a stop on the Underground Railroad. He also has great fondness for the Eckstein School, built for African-American students in the early 20th century, and he had hoped to buy it. Bill Parrish joins us now via Zoom. Bill, welcome to Cincinnati Edition.
Thanks for having me, Michael.
I'm so glad you could be here. For our listeners who have never heard of the Eckstein School, tell us about it.
Well, I'll kind of give you a cliff note version of it. Just to give some context to this interview, it started with Frederick Eckstein, who was a noted artist and sculptor, who was also called the father of Cincinnati art. This is back in 1823 when they first came to Cincinnati, and he brought with him his two daughters, Frances and Eleanor. Frances and Eleanor were teachers, but in 1830 they moved to Glendale. And most of us know by now that Glendale was a central station for the Underground Railroad, and they got established there. Frederick Eckstein really was rooted in sort of the Underground Railroad movement, and his daughter Eleanor did a lot of the work. She taught Black children who were migrating north from slavery to in a barn in the back of their yard. She did that for a couple decades, and then she created another school. And then ultimately there were three schools before Eckstein School came about. So the Eckstein School was named after Eleanor Eckstein. So the significance of that is that this whole movement with the Underground Railroad led to the Eckstein School being what it was. And so I think that's really the compelling part of history. I think we're talking a lot about brick and mortar, but I think what's happening here is that we need the whole story in which to give context to the African-American community and to give context to the contributions that African-Americans made to community. So this is a good, really good story because it started 200 years ago. And now we talk about what's happening now without the real context of the story that led up to that. So the Eckstein School came about, and the one that we know of came about in 1915. And then it grew to 1958, which is when desegregation took place. And, it just stood there for the next 60 years.
What's the condition of the Eckstein School currently?
It's a well-made building, so I think it's sustainable. I have what is called the Eckstein Cultural Arts Center. That came out of a process that I went through with the Village of Glendale starting in 2015, where the school was there. John Birchinell stated that the school could only be used for educational purposes, and it could only be purchased for $1. So when I came back to Glendale in 2015, I went to the village because the building was still sitting there since 2009 when Princeton Schools gave it back to Glendale. Nobody was using it. So they said, well, there was no plan for it. So I asked them what I needed to do. And so they said, well, you need a vision, a plan, and then a nonprofit. So I went through the process of creating the Eckstein Cultural Arts Center as a community gathering place centered on the arts. I'm a graduate of the Art Academy of Cincinnati with a BFA in Communications and Design. And I'm an artist by trade. It was really designed to bring the community together, not just Glendale, but sort of the Princeton District kind of place.
So you had hoped, Bill, to acquire the Eckstein School, right?
Well, I was in the process, and in principle, it was promised to me. I was going through the process of getting it for $1. But we got to the end of that process, and we were doing a third iteration of a term sheet. Then it changed. It changed to become a bid. And I don't fully understand why that happened, but I think what I'd love to do today is address some of the barriers. I know we're talking about history, we're talking about buildings, but there's clearly some barriers that are there due to how preservation is set up and how it's clearly designed to not be inclusive.
So, well, the school is I'm just going to say, Bill, that the school is, the village went through the public bid process and it's now privately owned. Do you have any relationship with the current owners?
Well, let's address how it got to the bid process. After the second iteration, and it was being bid, I made the bid. Now, I was I won the first bid.
With a dollar, that your bid was a dollar.
My bid was $1. I won the bid. And this was based on the fact that in principle, the building was promised to me in the first place, and why I have this organization called the Eckstein Cultural Arts Center in the first place. It wouldn't exist if there wasn't some agreement on a level. But the second bid, I didn't win the second bid, but the person who won the second bid called me and said, hey, Bill, why don't we partner? I don't have a vision for this. You have a vision, you have a plan, you even have preliminary architectural drawings, and you have this connection to how we can do this. Well, we were supposed to meet the next morning. Something happened on their part, and they didn't show up. And so when I asked, they said, well, we changed our minds about it. We now no longer want to do that. So instead of coming back to me and say, well, Bill, this happened this way, maybe we can work it out where you can get the building and your plan happen. And so in the midst of all of this, some things happen over a 3-month period. Next thing I hear, a guy in over the Rhine has the building. So that's where we are in the process. He's now.
I'll note that we did reach out to the village of Glendale for a response on how this process worked, and we received in part this quote: the village purchased the building from the Princeton School District in 2009. When the village decided to sell the property, state law required that we put it up for public bid and sell it to the highest bidder. It is now privately owned.
Yeah. I don't want to debate that today because I'm further along in the process of understanding how things work and then understanding what you can do and what you can't do. And I'm a very positive person in terms of knowing and understanding what needs to happen. I will never just address the problem. I will always have what I think might be helpful solutions to the process.
We're talking to Bill Parrish. He's a third-generation resident of Glendale. He had hoped to gain possession of the village's historic Eckstein School. It was built back in 1915 for African-American students and served in that capacity until 1958 when the local schools were integrated. Parrish is also the author of a book called An Underground Community, and that explores Glendale's role in the Underground Railroad. Bill, I understand that some of Glendale's Black historic sites have already been razed, taken away.
Yeah, I think, you know, I, in listening to the other people in this conversation, I think that the real issue is there's a new narrative being written here. I think once it's bigger than just brick and mortar in this sense, it's the story of the contributions of African-Americans who for the last generations, my parents, my grandparents most recently, and we have to become, we got to have this conversation about that. The preservation system isn't designed for the African-American structures in our history to be a part of that process. So unless we address this through policy, then we're going to have these conversations and we're going to walk away and it's going to be, he said this, she said that, but we're never going to get to the point where we say, okay, let's intentionally have a conversation and then let's have some design, develop some strategic plans in which how we're going to identify these structures and how we're going to save these structures. And then also how we're going to take the history and give it through our education process to our kids so that they have a better understanding of the history and where they came from and generations before.
Bill, what might be your suggestions for enhancing the participation and even accessibility of and for African Americans in the historic preservation process?
Well, I'm a self-made preservationist. I went through when I was trying to get the Eckstein building and a part of that process, I had to do the preliminary work on the building to get it preliminary nominated for the National Register. We had a plaque and out there and that, but it wasn't registered in Columbus. So I had to go through that process, a 30-page process with photos and all of that. And I learned a lot. That's how the book came about, because I found the history and why this was such a controversy. The real controversy is because of the history associated with the school, not just the school itself. So it's the history with St. Mark that's associated with it, that's an issue. It's the history associated with Revelation that is the real issue. So I found within myself that I'm now a historian and I collect information, and now I have a second book that I'm about to nearly finished. And I find that my solution is providing information in terms of education for people to be able to learn from. And whether the buildings stand or they go down or whatever, there's still the information for people to learn, learning tools.
Bill, what's the upcoming book you're working on?
It's called The Children of Eckstein School. It takes you all the way back to Eleanor Eckstein's first school. It does an in-depth into the children who attended the school. One of them became Mr. Hall, who was a principal of Glendale School. He was held back in kindergarten at Eckstein School, and he ended up being the first African-American principal at Glendale School years later. So there's some really amazing people who came out of the school. So some of the stories are about that. And it just really is a warm, heartwarming story, but it also is a collection of stories that solidify the history of the African-American in the village of Glendale.
Well, Bill, when that book is finished, I hope you'll let us know so that we can take a look at it and have you on the show again to talk more about that. Bill Parrish is a third-generation resident of Glendale. He's the author of the book, An Underground Community, which explores Glendale's role in the Underground Railroad. And as we just noted, the author of another upcoming book about Eckstein School. Bill, thank you for the time you gave us, and I do hope we can talk again.
Thank you. Thank you for having me. Love to be back again.
And you've been listening to Cincinnati Edition on 91.7 WVXU. Our producer is Selena Reeder. Our assistant producer is Nick Swartzel. Our technical director is Josh Elstrow. Our theme music is composed by Rob Fetters. You can find archives of our program online at WVXU.org. I'm Michael Monks. We'll talk again tomorrow.